in an immediate sense, for taking these job actions, nothing happened to us. No one came aboard and arrested us. The skipper didn't put us in irons or anything like that. Wait a minute, man. I was just wondering what you were doing there.
Oh, I was resetting the counter.
Yeah. Now, we got in trouble later. I had, for example, 3 tribunals with the U.S. Coast Guard for these things. The Coast Guard, this is not the regular Coast Guard. It was a special section of the Navy, like the FBI. We call it the Gestapo or the Merchant Marine. And they came aboard in Coast Guard uniforms. Later in the war, in special uniforms. Different than a regular sailor's garb. First, it was regular sailor's garb. I'll give you an example. One that I didn't lead any job action. I was deck delegate. I was on the 12 to 4 watch. I relieved at the wheel, and when I relieved at the wheel, mid-watch, I brought the second mate his courtesy cup of coffee. When I was relieved, an hour and 20 minutes later, at the helm, heading back down below to lookout, the mate said to me, the second mate, "Go get me another cup of coffee." And he said it bad. And I told him, "Look, I brought you your courtesy cup of coffee. If you ever get a second cup on that basis, you have to ask for it courteously." He said, "I make it an order, let's put it that way." And I says, "And that means you've got nothing." And I left. Nothing ever happened until it came time for the payoff on board ship, where we would sign off articles and get our money. And the shipping commissioner said, "We can't pay you. There are charges against you in the U.S. Coast Guard. You're to appear at the federal building 2 days from now, and we're taking your e-certificate, the key paper, the seaman's papers from you, and you'll get these back after you've done the hearing, and after the hearing, then you'll finally get paid off." And so I went to the federal building, and I was ushered into a room, and there were 2 lieutenant commanders sitting there. And one of them said to me finally, after a lot of silly questions, and no charges, he said, "Do you ever carry your union activity beyond union activity?" And I said, "That's the end of that." I said, if you got any charges, if you can show any subversion or anything like that, let's hear it now. Otherwise, I'm leaving." And the other one said, "Well, okay, here are your papers back, but you better not come back here again or it'll look kind of funny." And the other one said to him, "Yeah, you'd laugh like hell." It was as if there was some kind of trouble between them. And I took my papers and I left. I went and got my money. And that was the end of that. But I knew what had happened. This second mate had turned me in. When I left the ship, I saw him. And it's the end of the voyage. And the courtesy, "So long, second," I said to him. And he heard my voice and he blanched. And then immediately closed this door, and I said, "Oh boy." So I saw him on Powell Street, right across the street from Sir Francis Drake, about 3-4 months later.
In San Francisco.
Yeah. And he was standing out in front of the Yankee Doodle, which was a hot little nightclub then. And I headed across the street right in front of the cable car, wide open, running. And he saw me coming, he ducked in the Yankee Doodle. I searched the Yankee Doodle for about 45 minutes. He must have gone out the back door or window or something, or he couldn't have been hiding under a table that long. But that was typical for them to not have any charges at all, just try to intimidate us. Now, the Sailors Union wasn't giving us any help when these charges were pressed against us. So-called Militants Union. But one thing the Sailors Union didn't do, and that is what the NMU did. The National Maritime Union invited that segment of the Coast Guard into the hiring hall. And in the New York hiring hall, the Coast Guard had offices right then and there.
Was the NMU, National Maritime Union?
Yes.
Was that more of an East Coast union?
That was, yes, only an East Coast union. They had no West Coast ships at all under contract.
Did any of the people that you sailed with, were they NMU people?
No.
So there wasn't, SUP people would be on one boat and NMU people on another?
Well, the National Maritime Union was a CIO industrial union with all three unlicensed personnel departments within it. The Sailors Union was just deck, MFOW&W just engine, MCNS, Marine Cooks and Stewards, just stewards department.
Was there ever any attempt to industrialize?
Yes. There was the Maritime Federation of the Pacific, formed in 1934, in which Bridges and Lundberg and all the maritime unions were in it together. And it was a real federation. It was the best thing that ever happened on this coast. That kind of a move towards industrial unionism with some kind of autonomy of the various occupations on the ship. But that was split up and, in effect, no longer with any power within 2 years, because Lundberg, who had been playing around with the CP, evidently, won Harry Bridges' girlfriend away from Harry Bridges, Norma Perry. And she was a very capable political, left-wing political. And then, too, there's not room in one organization for two and who had cults of the individuals built around them. But as the CP had built a cult of the individual around Harry Bridges, and the SWP, the Trotskyists, had built a cult of the individual around Lundberg. And each of them had cut, without ever anyone saying so, the following deal. All CPers and longshore would support Bridges in anything he would do within the industry as long as he continued to play such an important role in making pro-Russian statements to the press. And as long as Lundberg would make anti-communist statements from the left to the press and other places, the Socialist Workers' Party would support him in the Sailors' Union. So that after Cannon came out in 35, James P. Cannon came to San Francisco and started the newspaper Labor Action and formally began to meet regularly with Lundberg. The Orthodox Trotskyists, in their famous maritime fraction of 26 deckhands, were one of the most conservative elements within the union, because they would not raise, like the CPers and Bridges, with Bridges in the LWU, they would not raise any criticisms in the union against any of Lundberg's policies.
Now you're sailing during the war, And one of the policies of the union is a no strike pledge during the time of war. Were these work stoppages, were they ever viewed? Were you ever threatened that this is a strike?
No, not from the union, and not from the government, in any direct sense of the shipping commission or anything like that. It was this Kafkaesque activity of the Coast Guard that was used to intimidate us. We were within our rights, were using direct action when the companies refused to do what they had said they would do by contract. Now, in the National Maritime Union, those who were sympathetic to the Communist Party were totally gung-ho for the war and were willing to give up any of the conditions that we'd won in the 30s. That wasn't true on the West Coast. When the ship owners would take away conditions, there was resistance. And it wasn't unusual. It happened again and again. Cornflakes, I guess it was, strike. The bosun raised the stink that we always had cornflakes for breakfast. And finally, the messman got the steward, and the steward says, well, tell us what you want. And the bosun couldn't think of any other kind of cereal, and he turned to the messman and said, what's another? The messman said, grape nuts. Bosun said, that's right, grape nuts. No grape nuts, no work. And there was no work on that ship until the steward came back, drove back from somewhere with several cases of grape nuts.
A grape nut strike.
And it seems idiotic and so on from a distance, but these things become symbolized. That is, the crap that we've been taking all along got symbolized in a box of grape nuts.
What about wages? Were your wages frozen?
We made $100 a month plus $17 war risk bonus. So we made $117 a month as able-bodied seamen. I think ordinary seamen made $89, something like that. If we were in a danger zone where there was big risk of being torpedoed or attacked, $125 a month extra. Or if the ship was hit, you got an automatic $125 bonus. Like that.
Did those war bonuses stay stable throughout the...
No, it was by supply. They were trying to attract over 250,000 merchant seamen. And the fatality rates was three times that of the Marine Corps. As soon as the German, particularly the German code was broken, and the U-boats weren't really getting us with the same ease, they began cutting down on the bonus. By the time the war was over, we were making about the same as a seaman first in the Navy.
Did anyone ever say, hey, the heck with these war bonuses, how about a wage, just a raise?
Not to my knowledge.
Mm-hmm. There's no...
No one was ever ashore long enough to wage a sustained battle. You get drafted even if you didn't keep sailing.
How was the longest you could stay on shore?
30 days.
30 days. Did you, didn't you at some point stay on shore longer? Was there any way you could stay?
Oh, yeah. You get a job on a ship after 29 to 30 days. But the ship isn't leaving right away. The ship takes 2 weeks to load, maybe. Or it loads something here and goes to another American port and loads some more. Like that.
When you signed off the ship, and then you sign on a new ship, you're pretty much always working with a new bunch of guys.
Yeah, right.
Was there any kind of a buddy system where you had some friends that...
Oh, a lot of guys. It was common to find in a deck gang of 11 men that you might have a set of partners, two men who have come aboard together, who sail together, or two firemen, oil or water tenders come aboard together, things like that. But because there was so much work, the men were finally free to do what they always want to do at the end of every voyage, the suitcase parade. Everybody piles off. No one tries to make a home out of that ship because everybody knows that if you make a home out of a ship, it's very conservatizing. If you get so that you really cocooned on a ship, then you're not going to raise any hell when they give you a bad time. If they know that you're here for this trip and then you'll get off, boom, and you're not going to make a home, you get much better treatment.
What was, when you were out at sea, how often would you hit, would you be able to get off the ship for a little shore relaxation at every port?
Not all of them. And there were certain islands where you could, for instance, we were at, there had been a revolution against the Free French by the Vichy, and there was a civil war between the Vichy and the regular Free French at Noumea, New Caledonia, French colony. It used to be a prison colony. And the Vichy were knocked out. They kept us there at anchor. I think we got ashore 3 days and 3 months of the 3 months accumulated time in that harbor. But most places, if you weren't on watch, you were free to go ashore.
Mm-hmm. And what did you do ashore? Depending on where you were, do you have any memorable shore leave?
Oh, yeah. Well, in Oran, Algeria, in a fascinating port. We went there, the Germans were still there sniping from up at the city. The port's down at sea level. And then there's a cliff, and the cliff must be a quarter of a mile straight up with switchback landings, both stairs and for vehicles. And the Germans were up there. And then the order went out, everybody, no one wears sunglasses because that'll reflect, and they shoot at the reflection at that distance. But after a couple of days, they were gone after the invasion. And I went ashore with a Dane who had been caught in America on a Danish ship and couldn't go back to Denmark because it was occupied by Germans. And he was a little older than I, and he said, let's go, and we went, and we found a brothel, a really fine one, where only merchant seamen and regular popular residents could go. No military of any kind in this place. Madame Rosette's, 2 Rue Boyer. And there were probably, besides Madame Rosette, who had marvelous dresses and with all these pleats and everything with the money and like money pockets behind all these draped wrinkles and a lot of money. And she must have had 18 women working for her, and it was like a 3-story, 4-story hotel. And also those women made beer. And it was the only good beer in town. And you could sit around and talk 12 hours in a row. The place ran like never went to sleep. There was 3 shifts. And I had been sitting there for maybe 8 hours shooting a breeze from all these other guys from all these other ships. In that convoy, we had lost more than half of the ships were sunk in our convoy. We left with 82, and we came into Iran with less than 40 ships.
Did the other ships stop and pick up
That was problematic, and that was the question we had for ourselves. When I would meet these guys, like, what ship were you on? And we're just in this convoy? Yes. Did you know any of the guys in the other ships? You know what happened? Those are the questions going around. We're all guys about 20, 21, 22 years old. And I'd been with two or three of these women within a 2 or 3 day period. And I was there very late. This is about 2 a.m. And a girl named Lily came to me. And she said, come with me to my room. She said, I'm going off. And I went with her to her room. And she was a Turkish woman, young Turkish woman, my age. How she had gotten to Iran, I'll never know. Now, all the sex I had ever had in my life prior to that time, in that period before the pill, was under probably the worst conditions anyone can have sex, in the back seat of a car, in the sand at the beach, in a rush somewhere, standing up, or with a prostitute who doesn't give a hoot. And for the first time in my life, I experienced sex with tenderness. Really touching tenderness. It was a revelation to me. I didn't know that something this beautiful or marvelous was possible. And so, and I was low on money at this point. We all were. But I begged, borrowed, I lived there. And I just turned the hours around. I would be wide awake at when she would go off shift, and we would be, and all of that.
Did you ever get jealous about after you had?
No, it didn't seem to me that I had met her already, knowing and seeing what was going on all around, and it was kind of the way things were. That was the norm. A normal situation, rather than the reverse. But I felt kind of special with this very special person. So when we were leaving Iran in a convoy to go on to Bazerti, I guess it was, go east, further east, just going out the mine gates, the crew messman is standing right beside me at the gunwale, looking nostalgically back at the city of Iran up on the cliff. And after he became aware of my presence, he turned to me and said, Red, you know, last night I had the best piece of ass I've ever had in my whole life. I said, where'd you go? He said, Madame Rosette's. I said, and I already knew, I had a feeling. I said, which one of the women? He said, Lily. And I still feel good about this. I didn't say anything. I walked away from him. He and I became very good friends later on. That's another story. I met him in Frisco, I met him back in New York again. I ran into him several times. He wound up being a skipper. He went after his licenses.
That's kind of a sad story.
But, you know, at first it seemed to me a little sad nostalgia, but as the years have passed, it has been a very up and joyous story for me. This young woman was revealing to a number of young men, and regularly, the potential beauty of life in one of the most creative areas of human existence, one of the dearest things to us. She was not treating these young men crudely in any way. Matter of fact, she could make them dance. And right flat on their back. And if I could only say, hey, Lily, wherever you are out there, thank you. It would be marvelous.
How old was Lily at that time?
She was 20, I think, 20, 21.
How about the drinking? Did the sailors live up to their stereotypical image of being
Well, the older men, of course, that had been sailing for a long time tended to be periodic alcoholics and dependent on it when they go ashore. The younger men tend to do a lot of adventurous drinking, sometimes getting in fights and like that.
When you were sitting around, you spent a lot of time.
This Dean I told you about, marvelous. We did want booze. And he went ashore and disappeared for 3 days, about the second or third day. He came back. He had been drunk the whole time. And underneath his T-shirt, and that's all he had on was a striped T-shirt, he had 3 bottles of the best vermouth you could ever want. And he'd had them there for almost the whole 3 days. He'd gotten them very soon after he walked off. And he took the 3 bottles out from between his skin and his belt and T-shirt, and there was perfect imprint of 3 bottles in his body, and his body didn't just jump out again. Those imprints of the bottles remained there. And he said, "I'm deformed." He said, "It won't go away." And we assured him, he was still very drunk, we assured him that really and truly it will go away, but you should lay down and take it easy. And we got him to get into the sack and relax a little bit, but the vermouth was marvelous. It was real French vermouth, and it was pre-war stock, and the Germans had not found it, and the Germans were really good at finding booze.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we had that.
When you're on shore in different ports, in a bar or a brothel, did and other sailors around, did you talk about the conditions out at sea, or did you ever plan any strategy of or work stoppages?
No. I mean, no one ever plans work stoppages. Work stoppages, if they occur, happen almost spontaneously. If you plan them, you feel like you'd be in trouble.
Did you compare notes, say, hey, how's the food on that?
Yeah, that sort of thing. But usually when you get out to this place, you might talk about what happened to this guy or that guy. Have you seen so-and-so? But usually you don't talk much about your ship and the negative side of it. You talk up. When you get off, you warn others about what a bad feeder this thing is. Mm-hmm. Or if it's that bad, you will stay on until it improves. Never walk away from a beef. If there's a grievance, don't leave the ship. Is the custom. Only leave a ship clean for the next crew. And the condition's good for the next gang to come aboard. And that's the only time you don't join the suitcase parade, is when there's something bad on the ship that needs correcting.
Do you remember a time that you had to stay with the ship?
We had a Puerto Rican boatswain named Pineapple Joe. And the skipper was racist. And Pineapple was Puerto Rican. And he was probably at least half African descent. And we decided that we would take some action, and that this skipper would have trouble with us. And the chief mate was a Puerto Rican, and he was over 65. And he counseled Pineapple to stay aboard. And it was made known to us that this skipper was getting off. So a new skipper would come aboard, and the chief mate is Puerto Rican, and the bosun's Puerto Rican, and you and I will run the ship well on the deck. So there was immediate reversal. We're not going to stay anymore. And I was the one who did it. I was deck delegate, union delegate. I told Pineapple that he shouldn't stay aboard, that it was wrong to get into that kind of relationship with the chief me. And he said to me in marvelous dialect, he said, "Brad, you don't understand. There's a lot of racism in the Sailors Union. And I can live better with it." And I said, "Yeah, you can live better, but it'll be at someone else's expense because you'll have a deal with the mate. You got to get off with the rest of us and take your chances in this world." He wound up getting the treatment in the Sailors Union. They were forcing him out, and he wound up finally getting, well, he was out. He went from the SIU or the SUP, or the NMU, and he was stabbed to death. I don't know the circumstances, but he was a marvelous guy and a good sailor. Mm-hmm.